Regardless of where the pages of your favorite broadsheet were printed, prosperity in the newspaper business is a scattered game of contrast the world over. And as many continue to prove, the role of the modern daily has always been an evolving art. So where do newspapers fit in today's hungry world of journalism? We'll find out today on The Stack. Coming up on today's show, it's all about newspapers, and we'll hear from the editor of the weekend edition of the Financial Times on how the printed word plays a crucial role in modern journalism. Meanwhile, in Los Angeles, however, the local daily has found itself in the midst of a cross-city tug of war.
If you can't, on a local basis, put forward into the marketplace, in digital and or in print, a product that keeps people reading every day, you become less and less relevant.
We'll also hear about why print is center stage for a Melbourne Daily's way forward.
A place like The Age has an absolutely vital job in being the place that people in this town, Melbourne, can turn to for the people that understand it best. Those laws haven't changed.
That's all to come on The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis show. Hello and welcome to The Stack with me, Tyler Brulé. Now, much of today's news cycle has been taken over by a ferocious appetite for constant rolling updates and annoying page refreshes, but we'll spend today looking at the unique ability for newspapers to take a step away from the race to break news and provide a studied analysis of the facts. And that's why we like newspapers that come out on a Saturday, even a Sunday. And it's great that my guest today is the editor of the Financial Times Weekend Edition, Caroline Daniel. Fantastic to have you back on the program. I wanted to start with just the role of the weekend paper. It almost goes from strength to strength. A couple of weeks ago, we were in Frankfurt, we were at the book fair, and it was amazing to see Die Zeit in Germany and the role that, okay, it's a paper that comes out on a Thursday, but it's a weekly that sort of leads you into to the weekend. So if a lot of people have been feeling sort of somewhat down about what happens on Monday to Friday, how do you feel about what you're putting to bed on a Thursday and Friday night?
Well, actually, we're in quite a happy place. The Weekend FT continues to do extremely well. It will be the last print edition left standing. More and more people are coming to me saying they only want to read it in print. And as much as we do have a digital edition, and we are obviously looking at digital, there is such a different market. And especially younger people really want to buy it in print.
Let's talk about the younger reader for a moment. Do you think that is part of it is also just a marker of being part of an intellectual class, of defining yourself as, yeah, and even, you know, amidst all of the other papers that might be out there to purchase at the weekend, that this is a certain marker for where you are in society?
Yeah, I think when people are sort of sitting in their Shoreditch coffee shops, they want to have a newspaper in front of them, and to, it is a social status as well. The Weekend FT does signify that you're a global, interested, clever, you know, non sort of obsessed by just the UK market.
Mm.
And so it does sort of signify, I'm interested in big ideas, I'm kind of classy, and you can't really get that reading that on your iPhone.
Okay, it's great to talk about people sitting in Shoreditch, but I also feel, I just came back from a tour across Asia, but I think the same can be said as well. If you're in Bangkok or Singapore as well, also young people who are, you know, we always talk about this emerging merchant class that we see in Southeast Asia, the young Thais, the young Malaysians who went to school over here, they went to school in Australia. The paper is also part of their lives as well. And now they're taking over the family business.
Well, as you know, I mean, 2/3 of our readership is overseas for the Weekend FT. And so therefore, when I'm commissioning something, I'm thinking about how is this going to play in different countries, not just, as you say, in Shoreditch. In fact, the best story I heard about the Weekend FT in print was yesterday from a man called Peter Humphreys, who is the private investigator in China, who was jailed in China because of dealings with the authorities, and he was sent to prison for several years. And he said one of the things which kept him happy and alive in prison was his regular edition of the Weekend FT in print, obviously. And he would then share it around with other prisoners. So there was a Nigerian prisoner in there who liked the style section, and he was reading it in prison, loving. In fact, he did say that he loved Tyler Brulé.
Oh, great. I'm glad I got him through his prison years.
I just think that's just, and I love the idea of, you know, we all think about people distributing bits of the print edition, you know, in their homes or over the, you know, over coffee in the morning. But I love the idea of people sharing it in prison, of how to spend it being shared out.
Yeah, I've got this sort of, you know, image of the entire edition sort of, you know, being sort of shoved under some, you know, iron bars.
Well, it was a bit like that. Apparently, it was taken in by this sort of local consul in Shanghai. And so I actually think that's a lovely idea, and I love the idea that people are maybe coming out of prison there and subscribing to the Weekend FT.
Does it force a bit of a rethink with so much, you know, so many people sort of moving into this, you know, this direction of, you know, how do we communicate on mobile, what do we do on tablets, etc.? And yet, we saw, you know, a piece by one of your competitors a few weeks ago, which talked about the collapse of, not, let's say not the collapse, but certainly the dip that is occurring in ebook sales, you know, tablet sales, we've all seen with Apple's results, have, you know, have really gone flat, etc. Do you think that there might even be different discussions in boardrooms, Caroline, right now, thinking it hasn't all gone the way we've thought it would, in fact, and we're in a bit of a settle down?
Well, I think that's a great question. I was just recently with Martin Sorrell, the head of WPP. You know, and obviously in the past, they've trumpeted lots of things which are happening on digital, particularly around advertising. And he's now saying, actually, you've got to go back to traditional media, because at least you know what you're getting, you know who the audiences are, and you can target them specifically. So I think we're actually seeing, you know, in the FT, we're not definitely not gloomy about print. We're not gloomy about the Weekend FT. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see an expansion in print, particularly overseas, with the new owners.
Very exciting. Let's talk about the new owners. Most of our listeners, you know, will know that we have you know, shared family. What would we be, Carolyn? We'd be sort of, are we first cousins at this point? Are we sort of second cousins? You know, I mean, the Nikkei have 5% of our business. They bought your business. or are you in the process of buying it, in fact?
And
I think people, you know, probably would also know that the deal is not closed yet either. Hopefully we'll close it at some point this year. Again, also people who are close to media will know that there's, you know, there's a few hiccups like there are with any type of deal. But largely, would you say that there's a sense that it's actually, you're going to a good home. You've got some good new partners.
Yeah, there's absolutely a feeling of some optimism at the Financial Times. This is not least Nikkei is obviously very strongly a print newspaper, but they're obviously moving to digital as well. There's going to be a lot of shared energy around that. The Financial Times definitely is looking east in terms of its coverage and what this allows us to do in Asia. So I think that's going to be a real positive. And culturally, it's going to be fascinating. Some of the exchanges we're looking at in terms of some of the younger journalists and what they can experience and what we can learn from them too. So I think it's, you know, I suppose what was revealing is we are a global newspaper, and yet no one was sort of having Nikkei being identified as a potential bidder for the FT. And I think it's, they absolutely care about the same things we do, which is sort of quality journalism and that global marketplace and that global reach. So it's going to be exciting next year, I think, to see what happens.
And I'm sure it hasn't missed you that when it's all done, you will become the most powerful female editor within the new group, which is quite something. Because I have to say, when you walk across the three quite remarkable editorial floors in Tokyo. Yeah, when you look at the bullpen of all of the editors getting the various editions out, there aren't a lot of women around. I mean, this is not news about Japan in general, but I think this will be interesting culturally as well.
Well, I think we've got a lot of strong women at the FT.
I've noticed.
Gillian De Bono on How to Spend It, and certainly, and another Gillian Tett, so who was a former Tokyo bureau chief and knows Japan extremely well. So I think it's going to be an interesting exchange on the women's side as well.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. My guest today, Caroline Daniel, the editor of the wonderful weekend edition of the Financial Times. And I hope that many people who are listening to this program live this morning are also spending a little bit of time with the paper as well. Hopefully the back page of the Life and Art section. We are going away for a very short break. We will be back after this. Stay with us.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tyler Brulé, and my very special guest today, Caroline Daniel, the editor of the weekend edition of the Financial Times. Caroline, we'll let you sip your coffee for a moment because we're heading over to Los Angeles right now, where last month, the Los Angeles Times fired its publisher, Brian Boitner, before quickly moving to downsize its newsroom. Well, this week, Boitner told CNN that the paper could not cut costs to find a way to prosperity and said local ownership was the best way for struggling newspapers to regain some of their dominance. Well, a little earlier, Monocle's Ben Ryland spoke to news industry analyst Ken Doctor in California, who starts by explaining why Boitner had to leave.
The factor was really a break in trust between Austin Buettner, the publisher in L.A., and the guy who worked for Jack Griffin, the CEO of the Tribune Company, which has big papers in nine American markets, including Chicago and Baltimore. that's what caused the firing. What stood out about Buettner's strategy in L.A. was less the digital experimentation, and there was some of that, but of course we see that on both sides of the Atlantic. What stood out about what Buettner was doing was saying, look, it's the product. It's the contact of what the readers get, both print readers and digital readers, and Los Angeles Times has to be a major force for the future of L.A. And so he would do hour-long conversations with the governor of California, Jerry Brown, on the water issues, the drought issues. He started a big education section online and in print. And the idea that the Times should be a leader in the community, reach out to the community, and then ask the community for support, both in subscriptions and advertising. This is a different strategy than what Tribune has been pursuing across the country. And they came to loggerheads, and they came to loggerheads very quickly, and then that resulted in the firing.
What do you think is going to happen next for the Los Angeles Times? Can they get to this point where they're actually appealing to the local reader?
There's a fundamental problem in newspaper economics, and again, it's on both sides of the Atlantic. The print advertising is going down so quickly at rates of 7 to 12% a year that no matter what kind of digital business innovation you do, you can't catch up with that. So the revenue keeps falling at these companies, and what's happening is consolidation. We've seen national companies roll up or buy local newspapers and consolidate all of the business practices and production they can to save money because they're making less money. Trinity Mirror just bought Local World 2 weeks ago in UK, for instance. Same thing here with Gatehouse and Gannett buying up newspapers. This is one theory of newspaper ownership, which is essentially managing decline. The other one, and the one that makes the Buettner example so intriguing, is exactly as you're saying, of saying the only future here in a digital world dominated by Google and Facebook in terms of advertising is to really serve communities in new and exciting ways, a lot of that through digital, and do that in ways that Facebook and Google and nobody else can. But that takes a long-term investment. So in LA, we're likely to see Eli Broad, who is a friend and former associate of Austin Buettner, put together a group to bid for the LA Times and the San Diego Union-Tribune, which is now a sister paper, and if not, if they won't sell, if Tribune won't sell those two, to buy the whole company with the idea of returning each of those papers, nine of them, to local ownership across the country. That's what we may well see develop, but I don't think we're going to see it develop till the end of the year or the first of next year at this point.
Well, as you say, their managed decline is perhaps the two key words. Now, I don't necessarily look at those as being dirty words. I mean, there's nothing particularly wrong with downsizing when the market calls for it. And I think we have seen other publishers around the world of daily newspapers get to this point where they are actually creating what could be considered a premium product. And when you're creating something that is seen as premium, people are willing to pay a premium price for it. That has been proven by other publishers. It seems to me that perhaps Austin Buettner was at a point where his ideas were just a little bit too radical for some other power brokers who have decided this is the only way to survive and this is how it has to happen.
Yeah, and the fundamental question that, and you're right, from a business perspective, managing decline has been done in other mature industries, which is what newspapers are. The problem is the product. And if you can't, on a local basis, put forward into the marketplace, in digital and or in print, a product that keeps people reading every day, you become less and less relevant, not just as a democratic civic influence, which is something we should pay attention to, but as a business. And I've likened it to what newspapers have done in managing decline is essentially taken, if they were Coke, a 2-liter bottle of Coke, made it 1 liter and doubled the price. That doesn't work in the marketplace. So that's what we're seeing going on. At the Times, for instance, they are now in the process of a buyout in L.A. that's going to remove 50 more people from the newsroom. So, yes, they can try to create a product as they try to cut, but the facts of the history of the last 7 or 8 years now is no one has successfully created market-winning products at the same time of managing decline.
That was Monocle's Ben Ryland there in conversation with news industry analyst Ken Doctor. Still to come on today's show, we'll hear from an Australian daily on why print forms the backbone for their way forward. You're with The Stack. Stay with us. You're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24 on a Saturday here in London. My guest today, Caroline Daniel of the Weekend FT. It was interesting, a little bit earlier, talking about, you know, all eyes on Asia. Does it force a bit of, I don't know, again, not a rethink, but it is interesting to also see how the Asian weekend is also changing as well. You know, in one way, it becomes, you know, quite westernized. And yet also, you know, in some ways, we also see how Asia starts to impact Europe as well, that, you know, whether we talk about sort of Sunday shopping and Scandinavian countries having to work longer hours to, of course, accommodate new Asian owners. Is that when you have a global title and particularly, you know, one firmly in print and also sort of living in a weekend space, which I think is also interesting from a lifestyle point of view, how many readers do you have in mind right now when you're putting the paper? Because sometimes I can say, I think I have to sometimes remind, you know, the editors that I deal with at the FT that I can say, hey guys, you know, let's not forget about Hong Kong. And they're, oh yeah, you know, thanks, Tyler. It's like, is that an ongoing discussion in the newsroom?
Yeah, I mean, particularly for a weekend edition, I mean, you're trying to do a number of things. One is to sort of delight the readers and have them relax. The Weekend FT used to be, the original editor said, this is what you read when you're with your pullover on. That was what the original editor said 30 years ago about the Weekend FT. So I'm absolutely thinking about, you know, these people are wanting to relax, but also they want to sum up the week. A lot of people who buy the Weekend FT never buy the FT. So you want to give a flavour of the kind of biggest...
Never
buy the FT.
Wow.
There's a significant proportion of people who only buy the Weekend FT and identify personally with that.
And do you think they're buying something else during the week, or they're just not buying a paper even, maybe?
No, I think they are probably buying, you know, looking at lots of things online, then less, perhaps a bit less financial. So they like the global reach of the Weekend FT and the kind of lifestyle content as well. But I'm definitely thinking about how to sum up the week. So if you were on another planet, you know, for the week, you can actually feel like you have a sense of the news agenda in the way that The Economist obviously does that. So I'm very much sort of summing up the week and thinking about the biggest global news stories. And certainly for things like Person in the News, which is an anchor franchise and lunch with the EFT. So this weekend we have Seb Blatter.
I was going to ask you, what's in the paper today?
Well, it's an astonishing Seb Blatter interview. I read the transcript, which is 61 pages long. This man has a lot of time on his hands to talk. And he basically says he has no regrets, which is one of those quotes which will probably be hang around like his neck like a noose in the years ahead. And certainly, you know, we have something on Picasso from Paris. We have a profile of John le Carré. We have a profile, in fact, written out of Asia from a former British diplomat attacking the Chinese relationship with the UK, which is obviously in a big kowtow at the moment to the Chinese authorities. So if you look at it, it's probably you would never have that mix in another newspaper. And I'm definitely thinking about everyone from India reading the newspaper thinking this is for me and not just for a domesticated British audience.
We're talking to Caroline Daniel. Carol, we're going to go away just for a little brief moment, but we'll be coming back a little bit later for a review. It also gives our listeners perhaps a pause to maybe flip to the Seb Blatter interview in today's edition of The Weekend FT. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Stay with us.
Do you ever feel like you've missed out on something? Have you been on the road? Miss the latest world news? Then catch up with The Recap, the best of the week's cutting-edge reports, comment, news and features from all the flagship shows on Monocle 24. Join us every Saturday from 1400 London time or via the Monocle 24 app.
You're back with Stack here on Monocle 24. Now, since the late 1800s, Australia's cultural capital has opened the pages of The Age for its daily fix of news analysis and liberal political dialogue. But its publisher isn't without its challenges. Like many old media outlets around the world, Fairfax Media has watched the circulation of its print titles dwindle. Last year, saw it downsize from a broadsheet format to a new compact size. But changing reader habits haven't dissuaded The Age from treating its print daily edition as the jewel in the crown. Monocle's contributor in Melbourne, Stephen A. Russell, popped into The Age's busy Collins Street newsroom for a chat with the newspaper's state editor, Michelle Griffin.
What we talk about now is audience first. So where is the audience for all our different what we now call platforms for print and iPad and desktop and mobile. What do they want to see at what times of day, and how do we get it to them? And to be honest, also through our social media reach now, how do we communicate out through all our platforms to them? So we have to think for everything we're trying to tell people, when do they want to know it, how do they want to get it, and how do we structure it for each audience and each audience peak? So we don't really think, oh, there's this thing for print, when do we put it out as well? We think, here's the story and how do we communicate it and what are the forms by which we communicate it? And that also means for print, and I think of myself as a print journalist, when you become a digital newsroom, it means you must think audio, you must think video as well. So it's been a huge learning curve for everybody.
I can imagine. Michelle, how long have you been in the business, and how much have you personally have to adapt the way you break the news?
It's both something that's been a vast change and also the main job remains the same. I've been in the business for 20 years. The business has always been in trouble. For 20 years, people have been worrying about the future of newspapers and it's always been in crisis. But, you know, back when I started, there were afternoon newspapers, and so early morning news breaks were vital. The Age has had an online presence since, I think, 1995, and a proper one that they were uploading news onto from 97 or 98. So we've been filing stories online for quite a long time, and I worked for websites on and off for a very long time. But you're always adapting. You're always, that change is the sort of the constant. So I guess for me, my new learning curve is to think video and visually, and so I'm learning that language, which I'm really enjoying. But at the same time, local, particularly for a place like The Age, which I'm Cornian, I believe, has an absolutely vital job in scrutinising and upholding this state and all its news to close scrutiny and analysis, and being the place that people in this town, Melbourne, can turn to for the people that understand it best. Those laws haven't changed. We've got different tools to tell if it's working or not, but the rules of being good people working hard to do an honest job have never changed, I think.
And now that we do have these various platforms, do they do slightly different things with the same story?
Yes, sometimes we'll write the story three different ways to suit things, particularly when you're working, say, when you're talking about analytical stuff. An area where I think the news mastheads that we can no longer call print excel at is interpreting the raft of data and statistics that come at us that we need to master to understand and that we need to question and challenge and unpack. And so if you're doing it for print, it has to be displayed in a certain way and the analysis has to be interpreted in a certain way. If you're reading it on desktop, you need to embed the graphics and the graphics need to be simplified. If you're having a video, the video needs a certain amount of animation and it needs even simpler words. If you're doing it on mobile, you need to package the information in a different way, which is why you'll often see a list story online and it's not dumbed down, it's just arranged in such a way that the eye can follow it when you're working with a very, very vertical kind of layout.
And that, again, that's not a new trick, is it? I mean,
no.
The newspaper layout was always about how does it work for the eye.
And it's
well.
Been evolving since forever. If you ever look at a newspaper layout from as recently as the 70s, you'll be shocked at how many things you thought were the ironclad laws of layout were ignored. And if you go back 100 years, then they didn't prioritise anything. They just threw it on the page in narrow columns. So
walls of text as well.
It's not like the news medium did the same thing the same way for 100 years and then suddenly innovated in the last 20 years. It's always been changing.
Michelle Griffin there, speaking to Stephen A. Russell at the busy news floor of The Age in Melbourne. Caroline Daniels is still here with me. I can see some rather sort of vellum-tinted pages. That's from Age, I would say. Looks like we've got a copy of a very nice copy of Fortune there, I believe.
I have about 30 copies of Fortune magazine from the 1930s. It started.
You keep them under lock and key, I hope.
Actually, they're not that expensive. They make amazing gifts. So it started in 1929, you know, in the height of the financial crisis in America, at a dollar a time. So vastly expensive. It's huge. It's incredibly heavy. The advertising is absolutely tremendous. And lots of sort of advertising for dictaphones and luxury trips overseas. But also a huge range of content. I mean, it covers everything from social life and polo players. You know, it has a great piece, in fact, on the business of strike breaking, alongside a piece on the business of burlesque. And it has wonderful photographs of the burlesque world in New York at the time. And I love the fact that it's a mixture of high society and a real excitement about the new industrial age. And the graphics I've never seen better. And in fact, even today, I have to say, looking at some of the graphics that the Fortune magazine had at that time, they couldn't be bettered. You know, they capture a sort of social life at the moment of West Palm Beach. There was a great graphic which had at the top, first marriage, second marriage, third marriage, and fourth marriage. Mm. And down the left-hand side, it had sort of Charles Vanderbilt III, married Flo Hanley, Manhattan showgirl, divorced the year later. And it's literally, you could see the kind of flimsy jazz age in one great graphic of the unraveling of high-end marriages in West Palm Beach.
How much are you around the art desk then? Maybe not, you know, shaking a copy of Fortune around, but just as the editor, you know, in many ways, you know, papers are quite fixed beasts, and they have deadlines, which of course are a wonderful thing, but sometimes troublesome as well. Yeah, I guess we've got such fixed architecture because, you know, in a magazine, I mean, you've got the luxury. You can really sort of play with things and the furniture can move around quite a bit. So your role, how much are you engaging with the art director of the paper as you close?
Well, we have a lot of great art directors, particularly for the Weekend FT magazine and for How to Spend It. How to Spend It is... What's amazing about How to Spend It is incredibly consistent in its architecture, as you say. So you know exactly what you're getting. And then the creativity comes in how to be innovative within that space. So how do you actually change the tone of the mood of the pages and have a rhythm going through it? We're doing a redesign of the magazine at the moment. But the fact is, weekend readers also like to have things in the same place. If you move a columnist around, I mean, we're not moving you, thankfully.
Thank you.
But if you move a columnist around, people get really grumpy. So you have to balance the need for innovation and changing the pages and working out what you're really trying to change things for.
Just before we go, you've probably got time for one more title. What else? Aside from Fortune, what else do you have today?
I've got So It Goes, which is a beautiful magazine. And in particular, there's this feature by about Vivian Sasson, a photographer. Every single time I look at it, I just think it's astonishing fashion photography. Mm. And actually, it's not really just fashion photography, it's sort of high-end art photography. And we also have a piece this weekend about, you know, how fashion photography is becoming incredibly valuable and expensive. And she is one of the people who is at the forefront of that. Mm. And I think it's a keeper.
Caroline Daniel, the editor of the weekend edition of the FT. You're listening to The Stack. In fact, that's all the time we have for today's program. Our show today was produced by Ben Rylan, ably, I would say, almost co-produced, co-booked by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And as ever, Claire Urban has been at the controls. We are here, of course, every week at the very same time. You can always listen again via iTunes. And if you have any comments, thoughts, ideas for other guests, etc., do drop a note to info@monocle.com. But for me, Tyler Burleigh, have a good weekend. Goodbye. We'll